Welcome back to Dakota Midday from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. Over the weekend, the third anniversary of Egypt's revolution was marked with violent clashes across the country between pro- and anti-government demonstrators. At least 49 people were killed, more than 1,000 arrested. Yesterday, Egypt's interim president said that the country will elect a president before voting on a parliament that amends a roadmap laid down last summer following the removal of President Mohamed Morsi. Egypt's army chief, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who led the coup ousting Morsi, is expected to run for president in upcoming elections. Joining us now to discuss the latest events in Egypt is University of South Dakota Associate Professor of Political Science, Tim Shorn. And Tim, welcome back to Dakota Midday.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
Well, the weekend, as we mentioned, marked by both celebrations of the 2011 uprising and counter demonstrations against the military-led government. How divided is Egypt these days?
Well, that's a good question, and I think it might be more difficult to tell than we can from the outside at this point. I think one of the things that brings all Egyptians together is the desire for the situation to calm down, for people's lives to get back on track, to bring the economy and the tourist industry back. But that's about where the agreement comes to an end. The problem is we don't really know how many people are in favor of the regime that is now in place. We don't really know how many people favor a likely presidency of now Field Marshal Sisi. We don't really know how many people still cling to hopes that the Muslim Brotherhood and their political organs will return to power. I think that any notion of a public opinion poll or real election results or even the referendum results on the Constitution, any likelihood that those are truly a measure of how the Egyptians feel is misplaced. I think we just don't know how divided Egypt is, but we can guess that for the most part, the Egyptian people are pretty darn divided.
Now, this past weekend, the government was firing at those that were protesting the government. It sounds like there's not much mood there on the side of the military ruled or the military backed government to not much tolerance for dissent.
No, and I think that's going to come back to haunt many of those who supported the military coup against the President Morsi government. When the coup occurred, and this was a remarkable event, I think we were here to talk about that then, you had a very odd assortment of political bedfellows. The military, former supporters of Mubarak, people like Mohammed al-Baradei, the leaders of the Coptic Church, even leaders of Islamist factions came together to overthrow President Morsi. But I think what we're starting to discover is that particular coalition is not as tightly formed as it appeared in the first day or two of the coup, that some of those who had supported the overthrow of Morsi are now experiencing buyer's remorse, because we know that the military backed government has no intention of going anywhere. They have no intention of truly democratizing Egypt, and that they are now expanding their crackdown beyond the Muslim Brotherhood to include kind of early stage revolutionaries, those who opposed Mubarak, NGOs, human rights activists, and even journalists. So I think that there's going to be some again, buyer's remorse and some regret that they had sided with the military overthrow at the time.
Well, when you go back 3 years ago with the overthrow of Mubarak, it was a military ruler, and now we seem to be, you know, it's just going back to where things were before 3 years ago.
We are, to a great extent, right back where we started, except with an economy that is even worse off and a people that are even more frustrated. And I think that is really what is driving some of the support for the current President Mansour and the likely next president, Field Marshal Sisi. It's just a desire by the Egyptian people to put the last 2 to 3 years behind them and to start moving the country forward again. Unfortunately, I don't see that happening, because we have seen more radical Islamist groups starting to carry out violent attacks, both in Cairo and in the Sinai Peninsula. We're going to see more of the secular opposition to military rule starting to raise their heads and they're going to be cracked down on fairly harshly as well. So I think, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same, and we've probably done a complete circle back to the days of Mubarak.
But even worse, if there's these Islamist terrorists and some of those uprisings, you mentioned the downing of the helicopter this past weekend. There have been some bombs going off in Cairo. You know, how big a danger is that for the future?
My fear is that takes us back to about a decade ago. The years are starting to run together for me. When we saw tourists attacked, we saw Western-affiliated businesses and offices attacked. And my fear is that the especially radical Islamists are going to decide we have nothing to lose. Negotiations and elections got us nowhere. It's time to return to a violent phase again. And we'll see a return to terrorism and then a resulting even harsher government crackdown.
And what is the status of the Muslim Brotherhood right now?
Well, for the most of the leaders are in prison. It is now illegal to be a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. They haven't gone as far as the Assad regime did in the 1980s in Syria by making membership a capital crime. But I think that there are no illusions on the part of the people who support the Muslim Brotherhood or who were members that they are going to be hunted and arrested and sent to prison, and they will be kept there for a long time.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. We're talking about the latest events in Egypt with the University of South Dakota Associate Professor of Political Science, Tim Shorn. He teaches Middle Eastern politics at USD. You know, going back 3 years ago, there was that great sense of optimism with the removal of Hosni Mubarak. Is there any of that left?
I don't think there is any optimism. And I think to a great extent, part of that optimism was driven by the fact that it looked like that the Egyptian people were going to have some options available to them, that there could be a secular opposition, that there could be an Islamist opposition, that there was still holdovers from the Mubarak regime, and so that they had options, and they were truly choosing their own course, which path they wanted to take Egypt down. I think at this point now they see no options, and really all they have is the fallback position of calling on the military and its officer corps to stabilize Turkey and to try to get Turkey's economy moving forward. Most of the issues of democracy and free press and free association become fairly empty if people aren't able to feed their families, if they're not able to afford the basic needs. And I think really that's what most Egyptians want to focus on at this point.
And that's why it looks like that if the Egypt's army chief, El-Sisi, runs for president, that it's likely that he'll be the winner, that people want that stability.
Right. And I think also that at this point, I saw a headline this morning, Celebrate or Be Killed, essentially celebrate the current military-backed regime and what they can bring to Egypt, or you will be seen as an opposition member and will be targeted for prosecution or jailing or both or death.
Looking at the last couple of years, what went wrong?
Just about everything, just to sum it up. I think that part of the problem was that we have in Egypt, like in some other countries, what's known as the deep state, that the military, the bureaucracy, the security organs were all very much infiltrated by supporters of the military regime, by supporters of Mubarak, prior to him Sadat, prior to him Nasser, that we have this deep state that simply did not recognize the legitimacy of the Morsi government, of democratic elections. And so we had that. We had President Morsi overplaying his hand. Part of the problem with transitioning to democracy that we see in places like Egypt is that there have been no actors, no politicians who were opposed to the government able to hone their skills, to learn about governing, to hold lower-level jobs and hope for eventually running for the president or prime minister position, that there was no training for opponents to the government. And consequently, you didn't have people who were prepared to take over after democratic elections and to actually run the government competently and efficiently. So that was another problem. Also, the international community never really bought in to elections in Egypt and certainly did not buy into the victory by Morsi and his compatriots. That tended to sound more warning bells in many capitals than it did sound the victory of democracy. And so just about everything that could go wrong did go wrong. It was the perfect storm to bring down a democratically elected government and to make a military regime look more popular.
Now, Morsi is still in prison.
Correct.
And Mubarak, there are the trials. What is the status with Mubarak?
I would expect that the trials will be dropped. They'll be brought to a close. Mubarak will just be allowed to go into retirement and eventually die in peace. I don't expect a government, neither the government by current President Mansour or a government under future President al-Sisi will go forward with any trials against Mubarak-era officials. All the courts will be ramped up to take care of trials of Muslim Brotherhood supporters, government officials, party leaders. We're just going to see the same people staying sitting on the dais and a different row of defendants now.
What does all this mean for the Arab Spring, as far as what it means for what the Arab Spring meant 3 years ago, and if it had any lasting or will have any lasting effect, or if it was just something that happened 3 years ago and that was it? And
the revolution in Egypt is dead. Mm-hmm. It's over. But we have had some good news, for example, in Tunisia, where the assembly approved overwhelmingly the new Tunisian constitution. And I mean, there were some times of concern and instability in Tunisia as well. But all of the actors eventually came together and understood that they were going to have to compromise to create a constitution that, while not 100% acceptable to anyone, was enough acceptable to almost everyone that it has its roots in most of Tunisian society. They're moving forward. So we've had at least one success case. Unfortunately, for the time being, that's going to be the only success. We aren't going to see Libya coming out of their Arab Spring anytime soon. Certainly it's over in Egypt. Syria is the same mess that it was a year and a half ago. The Arab Spring is, for the most part, dead in the Gulf states. So, unfortunately, what was a window of optimism and opportunity has, for the most part, closed in all but one or two countries.
Now, you mentioned Syria. There are the peace talks going on in Geneva. The latest news, they've reached a deadlock over the issue of transferring power to a transitional government. Sides divided on the future role of President Bashar al-Assad. Was there ever much hope for those talks?
No.
No. In a word.
In one word, no. The opposition's simply cannot countenance a government that keeps Bashar al-Assad in power, even if his power is diluted. And President Assad and his regime are simply not going to surrender any power. As long President Assad's tack is to say that we are open to negotiations, but we will not talk to anyone who is a terrorist. And his definition of terrorist is broad enough to include anyone who has violently opposed the Assad regime. And that, of course, then means the opposition will be at real risk if Assad retains power and eventually, some type of negotiated settlement is concluded. Those opposition forces will always be a target of the Assad regime.
So there's really no scenario that you can see that Assad would ever relinquish his power.
No, and we've oftentimes hear that there is no military solution to the Syrian civil war, that there is only a political solution. I would argue that if there is no military solution, there is probably also no political solution to the Syrian civil war. Chances are it's going to require victory by one side or the other for it to come to an end. And at this point, we're kind of stuck in a World War I era deadlock. It's kind of the new trench warfare that we see in Syria, that it's going to be the opposition holding certain areas, the government holding certain areas, and we're just going to see stagnation and stalemate for the foreseeable future.
And meanwhile, just horrible, horrible situation for the people of Syria, starvation.
Right. We're looking at the UN is not even trying to count the number of casualties and deaths anymore, but we're probably looking at about 130,000 people killed out of a pre-war population of 23 million or so. We're looking at probably 8 to 9 million people displaced, well over probably looking at 3 to 4 million refugees. Even they are hard to count at this point. They're not all registered with the UN. Countries like Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey are really being overwhelmed by refugees. And the fear that attacks, the terrorism, that aspects of the war, the violent aspects of the war, will actually spread across those borders as well. And we've certainly seen that in Lebanon.
Can the Geneva talks at all help in the humanitarian side of things?
Theoretically, they could. One of the concerns, for example, is the city of Homs, which is primarily a rebel-held city. And there's a concern that if all of the civilians are evacuated from Homs, then it means that the Syrian government will have carte blanche to use everything that they possibly have and or can acquire to eliminate the opposition there, and it would just become a scorched earth policy. So it's one of those it's really a catch-22, that if you remove the civilians, you are protecting them, but you are assigning Homs to absolute destruction. If you leave the civilians, some of them are going to suffer more, but you probably prevent to some extent the absolute destruction of Homs. So it takes us back kind of to the days of the ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, where if you remove the civilians, you're handing the territory over to the other side. If you don't remove the civilians, while it might slow the other side, it's going to cost the civilians.
In looking at Syria, looking at Egypt, is there any role at all for the U.S. and the international community?
Not much in Egypt. Egypt has simply charted its own course now. About all the international community can do is to pressure Egypt to be somewhat more forgiving to the Muslim Brotherhood and those who currently and will in the future oppose the militarily backed government. In the case of Syria, I happen to think that it was a miscalculation on the part of the United States government to demand that Iran be uninvited to Geneva, because what that means is that the Syrian government is going to feel less secure, which means that perhaps they're less able to negotiate, that they're going to be kind of jumped on by everybody else, although Russia is there and will work to protect the Assad regime to some extent as well. But I think that there's not going to be any long-term peace in the Middle East and especially in Syria without bringing all of the actors in, and that would include Iran.